Blog Talk Radio.
Marcia Cook, and we have a great show today. This is A Good Story is a Good Story, and it is June 4th, and it's 9 o'clock Eastern, 8 Central, 7 Mountain, and 6 Pacific. We're all the way there. I got there. This is a great, we're going to have a really good show tonight. Andrea Perron is with us, and it's so exciting. I've been out there posting things all day, which, you know, I usually don't do, but this is going to be a really great show. And we have joining us Candy O'Donnell. So this, we have a very interesting show for everybody tonight. Okay, I will say my messages first, so we will just get that over with. Okay, now Wednesday, we have a lot of shows for, actually, for June, we're pretty much booked, but I think that Virginia will be off in July, and I think that Fran Lewis will be off, but I'll probably not be off. I'll just probably pick up extra shows, which is not what I need, but I end up doing them because I love it. Okay, so we have Fran's show. Well, Fran's show is Wednesday. Thursday. It's 3 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. Eastern, and it's Mystery Thursday. And then I'm having a special show about the Lady Jane salons for the romance writers, and that is such an interesting concept. It's reading series, and we're having all four of the people that are very responsible for having this be such a success. Hope will be on, Leanna, Ron, and Maya, and they're all going to be on. It's going to be really a great show. And they're going to be talking about it because there are satellite reading groups for the romance that they're, you know, they are starting. And then their proceeds from all of these events that they have go to for women. And it's a really, it's so great. I mean, it's really interesting. What they're going to talk about is also that whenever they have these group meetings, the money is going to a women's group. And so we will try to be helping women because that's a good thing. And there's a lot of women out there that have to leave their homes. So it's abused women, and it's an interesting, and just women in need. And that's going to be on Friday. And that is, let's see, what's happening? I think it's at 3 or 2. I'll say that at the end of the show because I keep switching around my times because I'm trying to get people in when they can make it because, you know, everybody's in different parts of the country. And let's see, and then we have a Saturday, J.D. Holiday has her children's hour, a half hour, and that is on 9 a.m., and that is Central, 10 Eastern. And that's on demand like all our shows because you can always hear them, and they're on iTunes, and they're on World of Ink, and they're on my site, which is Michigan Avenue Media, and they're also on World of Ink Network. And we post them all over because everybody has different friends from everywhere, and so we're trying to get out there more because we have so many different kinds of shows, so, you know, there's a show for everybody. All right, let's see. Bethany, how are you?
I'm great. How are you, Martha?
I'm good. Did I forget anything?
I don't think
probably.
So. Maybe covered about everything.
Oh, yes. Oh, next Tuesday we have a show, too, at same time evening, and that is with Phoenix Fire Publishing Group, and they're going to, I think there'll be 6 people coming on. And we haven't had one of those shows, but those lately, because as we know, I tend to have more than one or two people on. I've been known to do that.
Full
anyway,
house.
Yes, and Andrea's going to come on in a minute, but I couldn't help but say, Candy, this is for you, because, okay, Candy, do you want to just say a little bit about yourself so we can introduce you and what you do? And you're so interested in this, I know that's why I called you.
My name is Candy O'Donnell. I'm a psychic medium. I have my own show on Blog Talk Radio on Sundays from 4 to 6 Pacific Standard Time, and I will be starting up a Tuesday morning show to where I will be doing meditations and some card readings. I do past life readings as well, and I've really gotten into helping people with attachments. I actually helped a friend of mine a week ago. Her daughter had a negative attachment, and she was getting to the point to where it had been 4 years and suicidal thoughts were really creeping into her. So I said, you know what, we can't have this, we got to do something. So I went ahead and I put her under, and with the help of the angels, we got rid of that cotton picking thing.
Right. All right. So that's why you're on tonight. That's why, because I think
Andrew, that's one of the reasons why I'm on tonight. Yeah,
yes,
I'm
you
really
are, because
interested.
I think Andrea will want to enjoy this too. Okay, Andrea, how are you? I'm so glad you're on. I mean, you know, we've been looking forward to the show. You are a busy person, and I thank you so much for being on. Do you want to talk to everybody? I will say one thing. She's also, her book, House of Darkness, House of Light, also it's there's a movie, Conjuring. And this actually is a movie. A lot of times people say they're having a movie from their book, but it is on in July. So we're going to let her talk about this. And they're with New Line Cinema, and this is so exciting. Okay, Andrea, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for inviting me tonight. It's such a pleasure to join you.
This is great, because what Bethany told, she said, oh, you have to call her. I go, okay, fine. Well, I'll email her. She saw you online. So tell us all about yourself. It's a very interesting story. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I was very interested in doing your program because most of the interviews that I do are either around the book / the movie and what and how they interact, which I will address. But also, it's so lovely to just be in a venue where the books are the things. You know, it's not.
Yeah.
It's. I love paper and ink. So.
Yes.
It's perfect for me, and I'm perfectly willing to answer any questions that you have. But one thing that I thought would be interesting for your listeners to address, for me to address, is the way that I published this story, because I think I'm one of the few writers out there who, on her first try, and, you know, at the tender age of 52, decided
that's tender enough.
Mm-hmm. And I decided that it was in August or September of 2007 when I started compiling my own personal notes, my own recollections, and chronicled them the old-fashioned way on recipe cards in a recipe box.
Okay.
And within 6 weeks of beginning that process, it was to my surprise, the first call that I got from a Hollywood producer. I hadn't even told my family that I was doing this yet. So I don't know how it got into the ether, but it did.
Yeah, because that's unusual for it to just get out there without anybody, you know, calling them or telling them or whatever. It's not
mm-hmm.
usual.
Well, for me, it was a clue. It was what I consider an omen.
Yes.
Because what had happened was Lorraine Warren had begun pursuing the possibility of making a film about our story. The Warrens, Ed and Lorraine Warren, were the preeminent ghost hunters of their time. They're the founding godmother and godfather of a virtual movement now. And, you know, some people criticize them and question their motivations and their methodology. However, everyone in our family truly believes that Ed and Lorraine came to help us. And unbeknownst to me, she was pursuing the possibility, after more than 30 years, of finally telling this story, and I found out the reason why. Ed, her husband, had passed away, and on one of his very last conversations and requests that he had of his wife was to make sure somehow, some way, while she was still mortal, that their story be told, because they always considered and spoke frequently of our investigation, the one they conducted at our farmhouse, being the most compelling, intense, disturbing, and significant of the many thousands of investigations that they conducted over a 50-year career together.
Wow.
As paranormal researchers. And for him to pass away without this story being told was a loss for him personally, and so he wanted to make sure that his wife did it. So I found out that's why I was pursued. I don't know why they contacted me first, but they did, and at which point I said, I'm writing the book. Well, a lot of gears started clicking in, and, you know, movies don't get made overnight. There's many steps and many processes involved, and contracts and lawyers and the whole nine yards. But those gears started turning as I was working on the manuscript. Well, the manuscript got to be about 1,500 pages long, and I had to decide what I was going to do and how I was going to do it, because it is an intensely personal story, and it's told, you know, I really appear in the books. It's a trilogy, House of Darkness, House of Light, Volume 1, 2, and 3. And the only reason that it's a trilogy is because when I finally decided on a publisher, we can't publish a book this big. The only one bigger is the Bible. You know,
right.
What are we going to do with this? And I said,
that is a problem. That is a problem. But you know what? It's a really good problem, because when you have already written it, at least you know what you're going to do with it. Because sometimes, you know, people, when they don't have it all done, they might not be able to make it a trilogy, or it might not work out. And a lot of times people, if the first one isn't taken, there's no point for the second and third. You know,
that's
I always
right.
used to tell people that, but you have it all done ready for them. That's
yes.
a good thing.
Yeah, and I sent it to one, I don't drop names, but I sent
okay.
it to a top publisher in the genre, top in the world. And before they even had a chance to read it, within 24 hours, my media attorney was contacted and said, you know, let's make a deal. And,
yeah,
and,
right.
and I said, well, they haven't even read it yet. They've
yeah.
not had a chance to do anything but skim it. And the more that we followed through on this, what appeared to be an offer, the more I realized that what they wanted to do with it is slash it down to 84,000 words, and at the time it was 350,000.
Wow.
And I immediately said no, thank you.
Yeah.
Immediately. Yeah. Well, I ended up losing my media attorney over it, because she wanted to sell the book. That was her job. And without my even negotiating with them, I said no.
Right.
Because right. I realized, of course, that their bottom line was extremely important to them. But my bottom line is that this story be told authentically, completely, totally, not slashed up into a million pieces
yeah.
where its heart is cut out of it, and it is turned into a bona fide series of scary stories with no backstory. They wanted
yeah.
to cut the history, the philosophy, the theology, the science, you know, the everything that's around. There is no story about spirits out there like this one. And that's to its credit, and that's also in some respects to its fault, because it is told not only from my perspective as an adult, but also in the third person with me as a child.
Yeah.
And how I experienced what I experienced at the farm in terms of my perceptions and my receptivity as a child. So,
are you saying that they wanted to cut the book without reading the entire book? They just wanted to start slashing without even knowing how important this was to you or the story?
Yes, yes, which is what, why no erupted out of me instantly. And I realized then, I put it out to 13 different publishers on both sides of the aisles, and I didn't get one publisher that said, we don't want this. But the trade publishers were very reticent about the size of it. And, you know, my response is, you cannot take 10 years of experiences with seven mortal souls and cram it into a 220-page book. It's
right.
not possible without, you can't do justice to the story. And
right.
I wrote this from my heart. I devoted 3 years of my life, an average of 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. And there was no way. It wasn't really a matter of pride or ego. It was about doing justice to our story
right.
and having everyone in my family represented in terms of their own experiences as well. So I call it a collective memoir, because it's not just my story. It's my sister Nancy, Christine, Cynthia, April, my mother Carolyn, my father Roger. And we all had different experiences, and my readers by the thousands are writing to me saying, I feel like you grabbed me by the throat or grabbed me by the necktie or just the back of my belt of my pants and yanked me into your family, into the 1970s, and I went on the journey with you. I feel like your family's a part of my family now. And for me, there is just no higher compliment. And I could not have attained that kind of reaction or response. And there are the haters out there. There are people out there who are deliberately trying to destroy my 5-star rating on my books, you know. And I was like, give it your best shot, because I have so many followers.
Because the subject matter, you know, I mean, this, you know, Candy will probably have a lot to add on that. But the thing is, this is your story. This is what you know to be true. Mm-hmm. So you, I mean, and this type of literature people don't always believe in. And, I mean, that's, you're never going to get everybody to believe in things like this. But this is fine, because mm-hmm. there is a huge amount of people that will be watching that movie and be, I mean, it's just a very popular genre, regardless of people that don't like it. There's a
well, I'll tell you,
that do like it.
There are some people who are responding to it negatively because, first of all, what they expected was a series of scary stories. And
yeah.
they get way more than they bargained for, way more. It's, you know, I have a degree in philosophy and English literature. I am profuse in my writing and in my detail, because when you have a memory so intense impaled on your in your mind that's seared into your mortal memory, it's easy to be able to describe it to such an extent that people feel like they're experiencing it with you. And, you know, I tried not to go overboard, but I tried to be very succinct and very deliberate and thoughtful in the words that I chose to express each and every manifestation which occurred in the house and how it directly related to every other member of the family. It was an incredible job. It took, there's no way to count how long, you know, how many hours that it took to put this all together, but
yeah,
I had to publish it independently, because the only way that I could, and I got the deal of the century, I have to say, you know, Author House has been very, very good to me, and I very much appreciate them. I did a lot of research, I did a lot of homework, and I chose Author House deliberately, because the first person that I contacted there, I made a connection with. I felt a spiritual connection with him. And even though he didn't stay with me even through the completion of volume one, he was the reason why I went with them, because he understood and he believed and he was a follower of the supernatural. And so that was, again, my omen. You know, this is...
Yeah,
I think
that that's true. And, you know, when you become, you know... Well, there'll be a lot of people that didn't take this in the right way, and I'm sure they're not going to be too happy, because, you know, sometimes they make very quick decisions on things, and sometimes they don't really think about it. And it is unusual before, you know, it's very hard even when the book is published, but when it's not even published yet to want the story is an unbelievable thing. Candy, I know I could feel that you want to say something. Candy, go ahead. Say something. Candy?
Yeah, I'm very interested in what you have to say, Andrea, and I highly regard the Warrens as well, because I actually had an incident myself in my own home to where I felt like I was fighting for my life and against an inhuman spirit. But good for you. I just feel that you have not only poured your heart and soul into this, but, I mean, everyone else's heart and soul too, and I applaud you, Andrea, for just moving forward with this and the research, you know, and I'm sure that I kind of feel that a lot of this that you have put into these books has been, you know, like tugging at your heartstrings, saying, oh, should I put this? Yeah, I should, but how should I word it? You know, and who cares about the haters? Oh, my God, people are just so horrid.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to knock you down for your 5-star review. You know what? My personal feeling on this whole thing, and I am going to throw in my psychic bit into this is going to be a phenomenon.
Yeah.
I mean, it is going to be wow. People are going to talk about this for years and years to come.
Yeah, because
I think
you know, they have really good actors. I mean, when I looked at the video, I mean, you know, they're really good. I mean, I like the people that they chose, and that makes
mm-hmm.
a big difference. You know,
well,
and
they couldn't have done a better job casting the film, in my opinion. really amazing. And the thing is, you know, when I first heard that James Wan was going to helm the project as director, I cringed a little bit. I hadn't seen any of his films, but I'd heard that, you know, it was blood and gory and some slasher stuff, and, you know, I heard Saw, and I was like, this is not what our story is about. But I didn't have, you know, I provided them, of course, they had volume one while they were doing the screenwriting. They had Chad and Carrie Hayes as the screenwriters, and so they had access to volume one. I had given them about 75 pages of stories and treatment, and I gave them an authentic timeline of events, which occurred over the 10 years, to the best of my ability chronologically. So I provided them quite a bit of information, and I also provided them with family photographs and, you know, worked with them in conjunction with them. However, I knew that this story is predominantly about the career of Ed and Lorraine Warren and what they considered their most significant haunting and their investigation. So it's really written from their perspective. There are a few liberties taken with it. However, it's easy enough now that I've Volume 3 is coming out in about a month. So all I have to say to people is, if you've read the book already, then you see where the discrepancies are. And if you haven't read the book and you want to know the entire whole story, the true story of what happened to us in our home, then you must read the books. And it's just that simple. So, you know, I'm comfortable with it because I know that I had the privilege of seeing the film over Easter weekend with Mrs. Warren.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, I brought my sister Cynthia with me, and I also met Tony Spera, who is her son-in-law, and an absolutely lovely man. And we were all staying in the same hotel, and we reunited after almost 40 years. And they walked out of the – Cindy and I were down in the lobby waiting for them to pick us up to take us over to the studio, and they came out of the elevator, and it was instant embrace. It was instant. It was – like we were just brought right back to being little children again, and you should have seen the expression on Lorraine Warren's face to see us again after all that time. And, you know, she was not treated well in our house. My father was furious about what happened. And in Volume 2, there's a whole chapter with about 15 subchapters called War and Peace.
Yeah.
And it was war. It was war. My father did not want them at the house. He didn't believe that what they were doing was going to in any way contribute to ridding the house of the spirits. He really had just come around to acknowledge the spirits. It was a very, very difficult and tumultuous time. And you know, when I spoke with Mrs. Warren in person, I felt the need to apologize to her for what she endured when she was really just there to help. But I want people to understand that the film is, it's based on a true story. It's based on the case files of Ed and Lorraine Warren. Even though I provided supplemental material, they couldn't possibly cram 10 years worth of experiences into a two-hour film. But I will tell you, without divulging too much, that it is an amazing film, and it is not what you expect, not at all. And I was with James Wan when the word came down from the MPAA, the commission that rates films, and they were going to let it go as a PG-13, and then they changed their minds. And they contacted Warner Brothers, and they said this has to be an R. Well, after everybody's head blew off, because
that means
millions of tickets, they finally approached the MPAA, and they said, you know, we would like a reason why. And their response came back in quotations. It's just too scary.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, there's nothing that can be taken out of the film that's going to change their opinion. So they just decided they had to let it go. It is an adult film, and it has no gratuitous violence. It has no gratuitous sex. The language is fine. Everything's fine. But people who were pre-screening this film, the guest audiences that they do, you know, months in advance of putting the film, they were walking out of the theater. And in some cases, they were running out of the theater. And, of course, they can't just leave the theater. They have to be debriefed. They need to sit down and fill out a paper and say why. And the reason that they were giving time and again for leaving the theater before the film was over was because the intensity was such that they couldn't stand thinking about what might happen. In other words, their own imaginations ran them out of their theater seats.
But, you know, one of the things is, though, that, I mean, I say this quite frequently, I really mean this because I am a screenwriter. I think what happened when you're all working together, I can tell you this is probably a wonderful film because how lucky it is when everybody works together, because it's when somebody does the film, somebody does the script, somebody does the book, and they never talk to each other, this is not a good thing because the movie does not come out right. But when everybody works together to get this film made right and you were there with them, which is good, and they asked you for your opinions, this is important.
It is, and it shows a great deal of respect. And, you know, my concerns about James Wan and, you know, whether or not, I mean, he could not have handled this subject matter or the cast, particularly of children, with more maturity or more sensitivity than he did. And I say kudos to James Wan for taking a very intense, very complicated story and making it so that, you know, the last thing that any of us wanted to see was five little actresses being traumatized on that set. And that could so easily have happened had he not been there and been so sweet and so kind and generous.
Yeah, you have to have that with kids around because it is very difficult. A lot of people will not work with children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't. And you have to have the right temperament to work with children in a movie.
Well, they cast the film beautifully, and it's, you know, the little girl that played in the last Twilight, the child spawn, as it were, of Edward and Bella, plays my sister Cindy, and she does it brilliantly. I mean, it's I don't know how they cast it the way that they did, because those children, all five of them, looked so much like we did when we were children. And to my knowledge, they didn't really have any access to any of our baby pictures or our pictures when we were very young. They didn't have that. I hadn't put those photographs out yet. And another thing that when I saw the film, I said, this is right. This is supposed to happen this way. Three things, actually. But one of them was that they reconstructed, they used a beautiful home down in North Carolina to film the exteriors, and then they rebuilt that home on a soundstage. And when they put the wallpaper in, they chose the exact same wallpaper that we had in our own home as children, and a very old colonial print that was popular in the 70s. But there were hundreds of thousands of papers that they could have chosen, and they chose the exact one that was on our walls.
Wow.
And the other thing is that when I was a kid, we used to go yard sailing with my mom, and I got an oil painting of a white cat. It was like a folk art piece. It's a pretty popular artwork, but I'm a cat person, and I fell in love with this white cat, and I still have it in my bedroom all these years later. And when we started watching the film, that's what took my breath away, was that that same image was propped up without a frame, the same way I have it, on the mantle board of their parlor in this house. And I said, well, there it is. You know, this was how it was meant to be. Because how could the stage and set designers have possibly known? You know, there was a little bit of channeling going on here or something.
Bethany, because I could hear she wants to say something, because I know she was waiting. She'll be like standing in front of the theater. I can hear that. Because she was, I mean, this is so exciting. Bethany, did you want to say anything, or did you just?
No, I'm just listening. Keep going. I have seen every video, and I have been waiting for this movie since back in the winter when I first saw it coming out.
They've put a couple of trailers out, and now there's going to be a big blitz. Now, you know, word is really getting around, and I'm so glad, because, you know, a lot of my readers, they're so great. They write to me constantly, and I still am answering all of my mail personally, and I will do so until I simply can't anymore. And then I'll put out like mass letters to my readers if I have to, something to stay in touch with everyone, because these are the people who are spreading the word about this story. 99.9% of the people on this planet don't even know the story exists yet. So they're the ones that are out there carrying the torch, as it were. I call them my foot soldiers.
It's so great to have this before a film comes out. I mean, it's very exciting. You know, it's just an exciting time when, you know, somebody has written a book, a story of really what went on, and then you get the film right away and you're around to see it. I mean, it's so good to have that union that hardly, you don't see that much anymore, and this is going to be so exciting. You know, I think mm-hmm. it's a great thing that I put, actually the video is on A Good Story is a Good Story, my blog, and I posted it today because they're very good videos. I mean, they really are. You're scared watching the video. It's like, you know, and it's going to be a great movie. I think it is, because I think people, you know, Saw, I mean, they had a huge following. But this is not like Saw, because this is a whole different genre, because this is your life. This is the real story of what happened. So I think this is going to be terrific. I mean, I'm looking forward to this, and I think that it's going to be, I agree with Candy, did you want to say anything else? Because I know we're not in the same room, so I know that you're thinking.
Yeah, I'm just enjoying what Andrea is saying. I mean, I'm almost in awe by this whole thing. I really am.
It's unbelievable to have this togetherness with everybody, because you've had directors on, and you know this is not like the usual. So this is so interesting to hear, because it just doesn't work this way. So I think, Andrea, there's somebody out there really wanting this to work for you, because it doesn't work this easy. Not easy, but you know what I mean, where everybody's getting along and where you're happy with what you see, because that really is a problem. That's a huge problem for people.
And it really is. And you know, the thing is that I watched it, they expected us to crawl out of our skin. They expected the four of us, Mrs. Warren, Tony Sparrow, my sister Cindy, and myself, to be terrified while we watched this film. And they were kind enough to send in an intern with us who was there to get us anything that we might need, if we wanted water, anything that we might need. And she had seen the film 4 times, and she was curled up in a ball in her chair at the back of the theater.
Yeah.
And all we did was, between the four of us, pass a box of tissues around, because the tears just poured out of our faces.
There was no stopping it.
Not only Mrs. Warren sitting there watching her life unfold on the screen, and everything that brought her up to the point where she encountered our case, but above and beyond that, it was revisiting the tenderness and the closeness and the true bond of love that she had with Ed. And, I mean, they absolutely worshipped each other and had so many wonderful years together. It was a real blessing, their relationship and their union. But it also embodies and captures the elements of our story, too, which I tell people constantly is essentially a love story. It was the bond of the sisterhood, the five of us, and with our mother, and even with our father, who was tenaciously belligerent about what was happening in the house. But still, we knew, even as children, we understood that the reason why he was reacting the way that he was because he was terrified. He was the only man in the family and the head of household, and he could do nothing to protect and defend his own family against what was happening in that house. And, you know, people ask us constantly, what is wrong with you folks? Why did you stay there for 10 years? But there are 100 different answers to that question. And in much the way they do a broad sweep of the story in the film, I have to answer that question in the same capacity. We were supposed to stay there for 10 years. We were supposed to. This is not, you know, when we were compiling our notes, and I was the only holdout left in Rhode Island. I moved about 6 months after I began writing the book, and I realized that I could not stay there. I gave up a very lucrative job. I gave up my tenure as a 20-plus year member of the Theater Company of Rhode Island, which I loved doing, one play after another, you know, musicals and straight plays, and I loved that. That was like my second life. But I realized that in order to do justice, to tell this story honestly and authentically, to have everyone involved in the telling of it, I simply had to be where my family was. And so I left my home. I packed up my truck and brought my critters and moved in with my mother and my sister Christine, who have a little farm just west of Atlanta. It's in the horse country and cows, and it's great. And a rooster that I could strangle. But other than that, you know,
Was that strange for you when you moved back there to be with your mother? I mean, you know, now after not living with them, and there you are again living with them. Did you?
Oh, no, we assimilated perfectly. Okay. I adore my mother. I just think of the cost of the phone bills. I mean, we were on the phone together every day or every other day for years and years that we lived separately. But we saw each other as frequently as we could, and it was always lovely. But now I wouldn't change a thing. Now I will be with my mother until the end. I will. There's no way that – see, the thing is, getting back to what I was saying about my desire – to publish my own way, to do what I did my own way, is not because I'm a control freak of nature. It is because this story is too precious to me. If it were a piece of fiction, I would have turned it over to a trade publisher and said, do what you need to do, write me a big fat check.
Right.
But it's not a piece of fiction. It is a memoir, and it had to retain its form and substance exactly the way I wrote it. And if I'm just, you know, I'm a hard woman, then I'm a hard woman. But I wasn't going to compromise in any way. And I was willing to sacrifice, as was my entire family, to give me the freedom to sit at an office desk with a computer and work for 3 solid years without interruption.
I think when you do a memoir, it has to be that way. You know, I did a memoir for somebody that was in a Holocaust, and you know, I've had some reviews, and most of people love it, but I've had some reviews that they didn't like what Sala had done, okay? But this is a real story. I wrote it like she told it. She's still alive. She told me, and I wrote it. You can't change someone's life. See, I think when you're writing a memoir, that's what it is. And if somebody doesn't like the way it was, it's not like fiction. You can just change it. You can't. Mm-hmm. It's what happened, you know?
Yeah.
And I think people, when somebody writes a memoir, it's coming from them. I wrote it for her, but I wrote it as she told it to me, and I'm not changing her life because this is a memoir.
Mm-hmm. Or because something that happened might offend someone.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's too bad. Exactly. You know, some of the criticism that I've received is that I'm very tough on the Catholic Church. And, you know, to me, what I find so incredulous is that demonology's foundation is in the Catholic Church. Exorcism and the belief in demons, the belief in Satan, the belief in spirit, the Holy Spirit, all of what we were experiencing in that house had its foundation in the Catholic Church, and yet the Catholic Church turned its back on us and suggested perhaps we go worship elsewhere because we were causing a ruckus in town. And it was just ignorance. And, you know, my opinion about that is that in, you know, the age of global communication, ignorance is a choice. That's just how it is. And if people,
True.
I understand if people are skeptical, I wouldn't expect anyone who had not experienced what we experienced directly to believe it wholeheartedly, just to buy into the notion and say, yes, of course they're telling the truth. Give it a read and tell me at the end of it what you think. Because, you know, I've had a lot of fabulous reviews around this, too. I've had people say that they felt integrated with our family. They felt like our experience became their own. There is no higher praise that I could receive from my readers. But the one scientist that I turned this story over to, who's a mathematician, professor at University of Arizona, very brilliant. The man is brilliant. And he was the only one that had access to the entire manuscript prior to its publication. And I said, just, you know, take your time, give it a read, tell me what you think. And about 3 months went by, and I thought, oh, he's just forgotten about this. Well, it took him 3 months to read it twice, because he had to read it twice. And then he wrote to me, and he said, Andrea, he's very sparse with words, unlike myself. And he said, Andrea, this is a masterpiece. It's also empirical evidence of the existence of a fourth dimension. Bravo. Wow. That was it. That was my review. But captured in those few words, in the same way that the film captures, it is essentially a love story. And all that we went through and how we protected each other to the best of our ability and helped each other through it. And when I was audacious enough to leave and go off to college in 1976, we established what we called the ghost post, where my sisters would, when anything happened, they'd write to me and tell me, excuse me just a second, I'm having an issue with, I have to sneeze, I think, hold on. I am allergic to privet hedge.
Oh, God
and it
bless
is in
you. You know, see, actually, I'm very superstitious,
here.
So when you sneeze, it's like you're sneezing on the truth. Should I say that or not? That's how I grew up. That's how I grew up. Everything had a reason, you know.
Yeah,
but
everything, and my mother always said that. Everything happens with purpose and reason.
Yeah.
And was as we were going through, it was no easy feat for my family to dig down and divulge. I mean, I told you already, I live with my sister Christine, and it took 3 years. I live with her.
Yeah.
It took me 3 years to get her to come sit with me and tell her version of events about what happened to her specifically, what she remembers, everything else that I had in the books.
Yeah, it's not easy for somebody
with
else.
Someone else.
It's not easy always to say, you know, like it may be very difficult for some people to do, you know, the story, to go through things when they're bad, but that's good that you had each other and, you know, that she finally did.
She finally did. And, you know, I've got a line in the book that I use several times, I use as really like mantras throughout the manuscript. And one of them is, do unto others as though you were the others. And the other one is childhood trauma, the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
My mother is a saint as far as I'm concerned. She's the strongest human being that I know. And for her to have gotten through what she did and to have rescued her children the way that she did and did everything in her power to protect us and would never in a million years put any of us in a situation where we could be hurt, had to deal with her own dilemmas in that house because even though the way that the Warrens put it, she was in a very serious stage of oppression. There was one particular entity in the house, which Mrs. Warren said was Bathsheba Sherman. My father and several others of us think that there's a good possibility that it wasn't Bathsheba Sherman at all, that it was Mrs. John Arnold. Who died, you know, many decades before Bathsheba ever lived in that house. But that house was, when we purchased that house in 1970, 8 generations of one extended family had lived in it since 1736.
Wow.
And we were the only people that were outside this family that had ever purchased and lived in the house. And our presence there created a ruckus. And 5 loud, rambunctious girls coming into a situation like that, we had no idea. None of us. It never even occurred to anyone. I was 12 when we moved in, and April was 5, my youngest sister. And we were like little stepping stones, you know, 12, 10, 9,
wow.
8, you know. And on it went. And my mom had 5 kids in 7 years, you know, so we were like little stepping stones. And children are highly susceptible and influenced by the supernatural world. They have not yet developed the defense mechanisms which adults acquire to block out what they don't want to know of all of reality. They just start to assimilate what they believe to be their reality and have a tendency to block other things out. And I think that all of you probably know exactly what I'm talking about. It's just easier to deal with life, as complicated as it is, without having to deal with afterlife at the same time.
Yeah.
And people don't understand. They're completely surrounded by spirit all the time. But it's whether or not they will allow themselves to sense it, interact with it, use their gift of the third eye, use their intuition and their sensory perceptions. But children's are naturally heightened. And the first experience that I had with a full body apparition in my life was moving into the farmhouse. And we were all unloading the truck. It was snowing like crazy. It was absolutely freezing cold. It was January of 1971, even though we purchased the house in December of that year. We didn't move in until we got through Christmas. Of course, my mother said, "We're not going anywhere during Christmas. We're having Christmas, and then we'll move into the house."
Right.
And so, you know, my pragmatic Virgo mother, there's no way I'm going to walk and chew gum at the same time here, not with big issues like this. So we stayed, we had Christmas, we moved in, and we're carrying boxes through the house. And I walked past what appeared to be a completely solid, very jovial man who was standing in the corner of the dining room. Mr. Kenyon and his son were packing up what few things remained out of their china cabinet in the dining room, and this man was just standing there watching them. And he had the most endearing expression on his face. It just looked like love. And he had kind of a quirky little grin, and his arms were folded, and he had his foot propped up against the corner of the door jamb. And I said, "Hi." Walked right past him and said hi. And he didn't acknowledge me. He just kept looking at the Kenyans, and I thought, well, okay. And I just kept on walking into the kitchen. A few minutes later, my sister Cindy comes walking through, and she said, "Who's that man standing in the dining room?" And my mother said, "What man?"
Yeah.
"Mr. Kenyon and his son are in there right now." And she said, "No, there's another man in the corner of the dining room in the door. Who is he?" And my mother said, "Honey, there's no other man in the dining room." And, you know, we were unpacking, and Mom was trying to get, you know, dishes put into the pantry so that she could maybe cook something that night. And, you know, it was chaos. It was bedlam. Nancy comes strolling in. She leans over and says to Cindy, "There was a man in the dining room, but when I looked at him, he disappeared."
Do you think this is why, I don't know, I've seen lots of, you know, horror movies and things like that, but do you think that's why there's always, I mean, there are children in most of these movies, because I'm thinking back to all of them that I've ever seen, and there are children in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because what you're saying is that child can just feel it faster sometimes maybe than an adult, or...
I think that they're... children are highly receptive and susceptible to the spirit world. And within really not that long, we all realized what was happening, but we weren't talking about it with our parents, and not even our mother, who we were all extremely close to. I mean, we trusted her implicitly with virtually... there were no secrets kept from my mother until we moved into the farmhouse.
Yeah.
And... about 3 months in, well, actually sooner than that, Cindy, I was the only one that had a big full-sized bed. Everybody else had twin beds. And I would wake up in the morning, and I'd have two or three of my sisters in bed with me routinely. And it certainly Cindy. And Cindy would often crawl in bed with me at night. And now this is just in the first few months that we moved in. And she'd come and crawl in, and she'd say, Annie, did you hear that? Did you hear that? And what, honey, what? And she'd say, the voices, I hear voices in my room. And they're all talking together, and they're saying the same thing, but it's a lot of different voices. But they're all talking together, and they keep saying the same thing over and over and over again. And I would just hold her close to me and say, well, what did you hear, honey? And she said, there are 7 dead soldiers buried in the wall. And that's all they ever said, over and over. And they would visit her practically nightly, and she'd get scared, and she'd come crawl into bed with me. And then, of course, here comes April, and sometimes here comes Christine. And, you know, I mean, it was a pig pile by the morning.
Right.
The cat didn't have a place to sleep anymore. You know, it was, Speaking of the animals, our animals freaked out when we moved to the farm. Had we known anything at the time, we would have understood that there was a reason that the dog didn't want to come into the house, that the cats were hissing and rearing up at nothing. You know, and as we lived there, I mean, we saw several animals. We had one cat that was a spirit cat that would run right through the wall in the bathroom because during its lifetime, that wall was a doorway. And we had a black dog that we saw routinely, and she would set off. I know it was a female, I could tell, and she would set off the other dogs that we had in the house. And one of our dogs, Jenny, she'd walk all the way around this very long, expansive farm to come in the kitchen door rather than pass through the front hallway that led to the cellar, because the cellar was the most active part of the house. And the well room in the cellar, and then the room directly above it, which was my parents' bedroom, and then the room directly above that, which was my sister Cindy's bedroom. And that's where the core of the energy seemed to be established. But I'll tell you, in all the years that we lived there, I always knew from a very young age that I belonged there somehow. And it's the only place that I have ever felt like was home to me. The only place that I've ever lived that didn't feel temporary, that felt permanent. And I was devastated when finally the time came to sell the house, and absolutely devastated, felt completely, utterly cheated that I didn't get to live my life out in the house. And my sister Nancy felt the same way, but my mother approached my father, and she said, "Roger, if I have to spend one more winter in this house, it will kill me." And she believed it, and he believed her. And they ended up cutting a very sweet deal with the for the abutting landowner, because I mean, they could have gotten way more for that estate than they did. But my father knew that my mother had had it. That was it. There was no more to be had. But I was the observer in the family from a very young age, and I've always been a writer, and I have always journaled, and you know, so I had reams of my own experiences to draw upon, my own memories to draw upon. And my mother said, as we were all what she called exhuming the dead, she said it was amazing after 30 years of trying to plant those souls as deep as possible in our memory banks, how remarkably close to the surface they were buried. And it's
just listening to you, I can't believe that people that we listen would not want to buy your book, but I would like to really hear you, because I asked you that, and I usually don't ask that. You know, this is probably the first show I've done this in a long time where I've asked somebody, because I really think that people, I'd like to hear your voice in this story, because it's incredible. You're an incredible speaker in general. I mean, do you go out and speak too? I mean, it's, you know.
Yes. I do, quite frequently.
People are, you know, I'm even speechless, which everybody knows is not the case usually. But, I mean, it's such an interesting story that, you know, I can't see people not really wanting to read this or find out more about this, because here you are the person that went through this, one of them, you know, and it's, like, incredible. So do you I know you were going to pick out something that you thought would ever.
Yes, I'm getting my cheaters on right now so I can actually read my own book. And, you know, I'll tell you, it's such a pleasure and an honor for me to be with you and to do this with you tonight. And
there are
places that, I have to tell you, it really is special for me, because I want to share this story with the world. I did not write this story to be rich and famous. I wrote this story because I had to write this story. This is not the kind of thing that one should rightfully take to the grave. It is changing the world and people's perceptions. And so for that reason, it really is my privilege and my pleasure to share it with you.
I know that Bethany and Candy, I mean, it's incredible, the story. I mean, it's just to hear your voice, that's why hearing your voice read some of it will be really exciting.
Okay, let me choose something that you just have to hear. I start every single, here we go, perfect. I start every chapter and end every chapter with a pertinent quotation, something that I believe is poignant and relevant to the chapter. This chapter is called Contact, and it's from Volume 1. It's quite short, and it begins with the quotation, "Unless you believe, you will not understand." And that's from St. Augustine. Okay. To become one with spirit, to be touched by an ephemeral being, no matter how briefly, is a wholly breathtaking experience, an ethereal journey through time and shared space. It leaves one profoundly and permanently altered. A perpetual questioning of the senses is abandoned over time, replaced with an unquestionable belief, as mortal minds are forced to absorb, then reconcile, an irreconcilable difference between dimensions, alternate reality in a new light. The front hallway connecting the kitchen to the dining room was the most frequently traveled route and least comfortable place in the house. Their dog refused to pass through it, regardless of any enticement offered. Over time, it would be recognized and accepted as a veritable hot-cold spot of supernatural activity, though no one immediately understood its full implications. Instead, they'd scurry through this oddly disquieting passageway, ignoring what could not be seen. Children moved quickly through that corridor, unconsciously sensing the presence, always feeling watched within its dark spaces. Nobody ever lingered long near a cellar door, no tempting fate allowed. It was where two of them had seen this man, a phantom standing in the corner behind the door, on the day they moved into the house. The other three had not yet seen him, but felt a natural aversion to that cold dampness, the smell of an earthen cellar seeping through the cracks of the door to avoid. Months later, when the children began comparing mental notes on the subject, each of them reported a specific, identical sensation evoked in that hallway, a need to evade a space. Unfortunately, it was a main route through the house and went to a bedroom upstairs as well. Both of the stairwells posed their own series of hazards. Cynthia was the first to make contact, physical with metaphysical contact. The school bus had arrived. She was not ready to go. Her books were stacked in a pile in Andrea's bedroom stairwell, clear on the other side of their house, right where she'd left them on her way down for breakfast. All of her sisters were leaving as she rushed through the kitchen into the hallway, her mind focused on one thing only, the books. Their driver was beeping the horn. Let's go. Cindy wasn't thinking about a spooky feeling she often had in that hallway, running far too quickly to care at the time. Perhaps that fact is precisely what left her vulnerable to attack, open to this encounter, as her defenses were down, virtually non-existent in the panic of that moment. As she stepped across the threshold of the kitchen door, Cindy was intercepted by a silky, smoky figure emerging through the cellar door. It placed itself directly in her path. There was no time to stop, no time to react. She'd inadvertently body-slammed the intruder. As she did so, it disappeared, vaporizing instantly. The apparition was indistinguishable, more a mass than an actual form. At point of impact, its intense odor and frigidity all but halted her momentum, knocking her back in her tracks. She breathed it deeply into her lungs with a gasp of frozen air. This sudden, foul influx caused her body to lurch into spasms, coughing convulsively, propelling the girl forward with violent jolts, a reflexive reaction. It had literally stopped her cold. As her sisters boarded the bus, their driver waited less impatiently, reassured that Cindy was on her way. She'd finally made it to the bus stop, but her mother was picking her up from school within the hour. What happened adversely affected the youngster in a way she could not recognize as cause. The normally boundless energy of an 8-year-old had been depleted, her sprint rudely interrupted, abruptly and inexplicably by something wicked. When Cynthia fell asleep at her desk, the teacher called the nurse. Carolyn put her into bed, and there the child remained, sleeping for the next 2 days and straight through the nights. Nobody suspected anything more sinister than the onset of a cold. In a way, that's exactly what it was. It took time for her to fully recover from a contact which occurred between mortal and immortal one chilly winter morning. This metaphysical intermingling, though brief, effectively robbed the child of her life force. It required an inordinate amount of time to replenish. Cindy didn't have a virus or a cold. She had an encounter. Contact was made. It was what they did and how they did it, how they could and would usurp, then divert a form of energy for their own nefarious purposes. They took whatever they wanted from whatever source was available, so to manifest as form. The spirits drained energy from the house and its inhabitants in a variety of ways, but nobody realized it or suspected anything of the kind for months to come. Even when this did occur to Carolyn, she doubted her own intuition about it. This concept seemed entirely implausible, and yet it was precisely what was happening in the house. Cynthia was the initial point of contact, the first one to feel the stunning sensation, the passing essence of death itself, stealing and stalking whatever it could as a method of manifestation, as a method of infiltration. And I end it with, there is a land of the living and a land of the dead, and the bridge is love, the only survival, the only meaning.
Oh, my God.
Thornton Wilder.
It was just incredible. I assumed it would be. I just had a feeling. Oh, my God. Yeah, you see, right, there are people in the chat room saying that, right, it said this is like nothing that anybody has ever read. So it's unbelievable. And that's why
I could feel her words.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, you feel them, sense them. You can see what is going on with this particular incident, and it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, I think the people that will feel it will feel it. You know, if the people that won't like it, there's nothing, like Candy said before, there's nothing you can do about that. I mean, but the people that will like it will love it because they get it. You have to get it.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. You have to get it. Yeah.
Plus,
and
if you have experienced something similar to this, you will have a thorough understanding. I actually lived in a house in Washington State that was built in the early 1800s, and a lot of the things you're describing were in that house. And I hated the basement. The basement had this heater. And remember those old heaters? It looked like a huge octopus.
Yes.
That's what it had. And every time I went down there, I could sense. And I knew there was something down there. And my aunt used to always say, can you go get me a loaf of bread? And my first thought was, hell no, go get it yourself.
No, go get it yourself.
Running into those things, it's
you have
crazy.
To feel, you do, you have to, you, I think you're right, people that have had that, you know, I had, you know, when I do screenplays, I always said I would never do a horror story. And my editor, Jeff Fleischer, and myself, we did one. And it was, I mean, I really enjoyed doing it. And, you know, when you're reading this, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I did want, you know, it's like I'm doing romance, I'm doing other things. But you're right, sometimes you block certain things out of your mind. And it's true, though. I mean, because I even know that, you know, but now that you're, like, I'm listening to you and what you went through, this is reality for you. And this is reality when people are feeling this is what happens to them. I mean, I don't think you can make up these things because you feel it. It's something in you, you know.
It truly
to write like the way what we just heard, no, you have to have been there, done that. I mean, you can't. You just, being an author and a writer, you can't just, some things are too close, and when you feel it, you can hear it in every word that you write. It's
now you understand why I've been so protective and defensive of the project and would not let an editor, you know, I'm perfectly capable of editing my own work and making sure I dare anybody to find a mistake in either of the two volumes.
That's really funny that you were thinking that because, you know, my usual thing to ask would be, you know, how did they edit that? Were you happy with that? But in your case, I know you couldn't have anybody edit it. There could be no way that somebody could edit that and make it still sound the same way because they don't feel what you're feeling.
Mm-hmm. And I write very lyrically, and I write in a way that I love language, and I play with it, and I break all the rules. I break all of the rules. You know, I am all for the fragmented sentence. I talk in fragmented sentences
good,
sometimes.
Right, exactly.
To me, you know, some of the greatest writers, I'll take their quotations and I'll put them into my computer and, you know, all the lines are coming up. You know, they broke this rule and they broke that rule, whether some of the greatest writers that ever lived. I think rules are made to be broken, and I wrote
this
book.
Oh, that's my motto.
That's the motto of the show.
That's my motto. I believe that.
It was House of Darkness, House of Light. It was both. It was a wonderful experience. It was truly a momentous experience. It was what I consider the best decade of my life. I grew up in paradise. And even though, you know, the thing is, I've lived my whole life from the age of 12 years old, never fearing death. I've never had what so many people limit their own lives because they're so afraid. They're fear-based carbon units, and there's no need to be afraid of anything in life.
Wow.
Anything. And if we could live what we lived and come out on the other side the way that we did, whole, and this was a very cathartic experience writing this for me personally, but I think also for everyone else in the family, because we went for decades, we didn't even talk about it amongst ourselves.
Wow.
It was let's just move on with life, you know, and bringing it all back to the surface, I thought that it was just going to be a hodgepodge, lodge, a mess of everybody's different recollections. And when I put the entire thing together with all of my different notebooks and everybody's interviews, I had to change one thing. I had to change one season where an event happened from spring to fall. I had the season wrong, not the event.
It's almost amazing, you know, and to, you know, to think that you have gone through all this work, the best thing I can tell you is that it's actually, people actually accepted it, and you have it in a book and you have it in a movie, which, you know, it is such a hard thing to have done, get a movie made. And I think you should be so proud of yourself that they did this for you, because it doesn't just happen. So,
I know,
yeah,
it
I
doesn't.
Think there's somebody that wants, I mean, you're probably right that that there's a reason that you did this, because this is, you know, Hollywood is Hollywood. This doesn't just happen. You know,
okay.
I mean, and I'm so happy for you that you are feeling this way, because you got to say what you wanted, and very seldom do people get to say what they want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and have it done right, and have it done right. So much for editors. That's a good thing. Yes.
Well,
that's important.
Nobody could have gone through it the way that I did, with the care and the consistency. And in places it is somewhat redundant, because it's so long that I will tell people and remember it with just, you know, a little bit of a paragraph, bring them back to something that happened in Volume 1, because it pertains to what's happening now in Volume 2. There's nothing in there that I wouldn't retract a word of it, because it just poured and it flowed from me, and it was spirit guided.
I think that might be good for people, though, because, you know, what you just said right now, because the fact is, sometimes when you're reading a series, and certainly, you know, one of this depth, that the reader that doesn't read it all straight through might forget an incident. So
mm-hmm.
when you're bringing it back up there, it refreshes their mind, and then
mm-hmm.
they truly get the picture of it, rather than having to go back into the first story and or whatever and looking for what you said. So I think, see, this is why. You're right. Rules are to be broken. And to make the story right, you did the right thing.
I think it's being considerate to my reader to remind them that this happened then and it pertains to this now. You know, in other words, let's revisit this briefly so that this makes more sense.
Right.
Because it isn't written exactly chronologically. I give my readers a great deal of credit for their innate intelligence. And I figure I start it prior to moving to the farm, when we lived in the suburb of Providence known as Cumberland, Rhode Island, and everything that happened that catapulted us into that farm. It was all important. And if I had left it out, when you read Volume 1, you'll know. If I had left the first 60 pages out and just started when we moved to the farm, you would lose so much of the texture and, you know, the three-dimensional life that we had before we began living a four-dimensional life. And everything that happened to seem to happen, not seem, it did happen specifically and precisely as it did, as if the universe were conspiring to take us out of the suburbs and put us on that farm. It fell into place perfectly. and it shouldn't have. And that's the point of the first 60 pages and how where we lived and how we changed from the moment that we went to look at that farm as a family. None of us even felt like we belonged where we were actually living anymore. We all sensed it as home. All of us did. And we all knew our way around a 200-acre piece of property. You know, how? Now, how is that possible? There are elements of this story that are quite literally unbelievable. I tell people that all the time. A leap of faith is required on your part to believe some of the stories that are included in this memoir. And there's a reason that we waited 30 years to tell our story of darkness and light, because the world had to mature. People had to evolve psychologically, intellectually, become more open to the notion that spirits exist. And this is, in some cases, how they exist. There were at least a dozen ghosts in our house, some of whom we knew personally, some of whom we interacted with.
This is unbelievable. Candy said, you know, goodbye, that she was leaving, but I can speak with her on this. I'm sure she's going to want to hear you on a show. This I can tell you. You know, and you are so welcome to come back here at any time. I mean, Bethany, is there anything you wanted to add of this? Because I know what everybody wanted to know, but I guess, you know, because that's why I asked Candy, because I know this is something she believes so highly in, and she's so much into it. You know, I've known her for years, and she's a great interviewer. So I was happy that she came on, because this is so important that, you know, that you feel that this, you did the right thing. And I think you did do the right thing, because you're happy with it, and, you know, your family is satisfied with what you did, and it's getting out there to other people who, and it, what you're saying is people shouldn't be as scared to die. So that, I think, in itself, is, I agree with you, people are very afraid of dying. So I think if you're bringing that lightness to them, I think it might make their life better.
Yes, I think so too. And so many people have divulged things to me that they've never told anyone, not their husbands or wives, not their children, not their parents, not their siblings, that happened to them in their lives, that they now feel liberated to share. And that, what a saving grace that is, because millions and millions of mortal souls have been touched by immortal souls on this planet, and they are terrified to tell the truth about it because they don't want to be perceived as insane. Well, I'll tell you, I'm about as sane as a human being comes, and so is everybody else in my family. And we evolved spiritually as a family in fundamental ways. My mother was virtually an atheist when we moved into that farm, and she left a devoutly spiritual woman. It doesn't mean that she was attached to any particular religion. In fact, she's not at all. None of us are. But each one of us is directly in contact with spirit on a daily basis. We moved into that farm as a normal family, and we left as a paranormal family. Once you are touched by spirit, once that door is opened, it can never be closed again. You can ignore it, you can walk past it and pretend that it's not open, but it is. And it remains that way for the course of your life. And it would have been irresponsible, and it would have been essentially cruel to have kept this story from the world. And the people that don't believe it, they don't have to believe it. The skeptics are the ones that move the momentum forward in terms of the supernatural research being done. Someday science will answer these questions. I always believed that when science and faith embraced and began to work in tandem, that there would be great revelations that came forth from that. But some of our greatest minds, including Albert Einstein, was a faithful man. Yeah. And
it isn't about religion or whatever. It's not religion or social. It's not economic. It's not about that. It's about how you feel. And you've really mapped it out here, I'll tell you. I mean, it's incredible.
I had a moment of panic when earlier today, and I said, and how long is the show?
I know that.
And you said an hour, and I said, oh, we're going to just scratch the surface in an hour.
Well, I actually book it for two, but I know, you know, because people that are listening, you know, that's why Candy, you know, I don't even know if she had dinner, but I knew she wouldn't want to miss this. There's several other people that I emailed separately because I know how they feel about this. And It's been great. And do you want to give your website and everything? Anytime, just email me. You are more than welcome if you want to talk about anything that will you can come on, because that's the show is anything. And Bethany and I mean, it's been great. Really, I can't tell you. And it's, you know, we wish you luck, because I really know that by the and I know how good these actors are. And I'm glad that they chose these actors, mm-hmm. because these are not actors that are out every minute. And so mm-hmm. I think this will be so believable, because it's not going to be like you're looking at someone you see on TV every day.
Right, exactly.
So they did a
and
great
they
job
all have a
casting.
Very good reputation, and they did
a
fantastic
God.
Job. Every single one of
yeah.
them did a fabulous job with their roles.
And it's you don't know how, because I do both screenwriting, and to hear that you are so happy with the film is such a incredible thing, because usually that does not happen.
I know,
and
but
it's great.
I felt the love and respect when I saw the film, and as Cindy and I passed the box of tissues back and forth, we realized that we were watching something very special,
right.
and that a great deal, I mean, these were not just people making a movie, just another movie. They knew the significance of it, and even though, you know, there are some discrepancies, yes, there are, there are things, you know, fodder for conversation later on down the road. That's fine.
Yep.
That's fine.
That's important, conversation about this.
It is. And, you know, the thing is that it is told from the perspective of Ed and Lorraine Warren. So it's, in many ways, it's not what you expect at all. It's not. You're going to be absolutely blown away when you see this movie.
Right, right. And so, see, that's the thing. One, the people sometimes don't understand. Just because he did Saw does not mean this movie is Saw. See,
no.
It just means that's one of the projects he did. That doesn't
yes,
mean
exactly.
every movie he makes is going to be like that. So I think, you know, sometimes it sounds good when they put that out, but sometimes then people go like, oh, it's just like that. No, it's not going to.
No.
You can see this is not the same thing.
I've never seen another film like it. I never have. It doesn't fall into any one category. I don't think of it as a horror film, although many people would dispute that. I think of it really much more as a, you know, perhaps a psychological and a supernatural thriller.
I happen to agree with you on that, because when we finished doing the horror film, I mm-hmm. thought to me, I said, I don't feel like this is horror. I feel like this is a deep, dark thriller. But I don't feel that when you say horror, people go like, oh, I don't want to go see that. That's not true. It's just, it's trauma, it's dark, but that doesn't mean that's not what people should not see. And when they put horror to it, people go, oh, I don't want to see this. And that's wrong. You know, you have to give the movie a chance. You can't
mm-hmm.
look at something as just horror. It's not, because this is your life, but it's also trauma and darkness.
Yes, it is. Well, and that was the thing that I was very concerned about initially, because I did not want our family saga to be entertainment. You know, we lived this. And yes, now it's a feature motion picture, and it falls into the category of entertainment. And some people will perceive it that way. Some people will perceive it as informative and perhaps even educational. And other people will say, this is too out there to be real. In fact, when the screenwriters, according to one of the producers, told me that they used some of our material of what I provided for them, and the upper echelon of the executives at the studio said, you have to change that. You're going to have to tone that down. That's just unbelievable. Well, that was the truth.
I know.
That was the truth, darling.
I know. That's how it goes. I know. There are things that happen in life that you can say that it didn't happen, but it does happen. Okay, and your website that they can see, I think you changed a few things. You added something, I think, on...
Yes, because I am appearing this weekend at... Through the Veil Paracon in Atlanta, which is the theme of it this year is Holy Shift.
Oh, good.
And I've prepared an entirely new presentation that no one has heard. The presentation that I've been doing, and I change it always. I never use notes. I just do my own thing every time I get up there and just shoot from the hip. But
I know.
That's my show.
No notes.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, if you just can't be out there and real and be yourself and communicate,
Right.
you know, if everything is scripted in life, you know, where's the spontaneity in that? you know, I've been doing a thing that you can find out on my, one version of it that you can find out on my YouTube channel, and it's called The Biggest Chill. And that presentation is based on the fact that, you know, the original film, The Big Chill, was about a group of peers who had to come to terms with their own mortality when they lost one of their own to suicide. Mm-hmm. And so that's the whole theme of that film. And it's interesting, and it's wonderful, and it's very enlightening in its own right. However, what my presentation is about, humanity being at the crossroads and the precipice of the biggest chill, and that is coming to terms with our immortality, coming to terms with the fact that when we die, we our energy transmutes, transforms. There is a soul, there is spirit, and that it is as real and tangible as we are in flesh and bone, that ashes to ashes, dust to dust only pertains to our physical vessel, which holds what we essentially are, which is spirit. And so that's the nature of that. And what I talked about is how living at the farm really brought us all to that level of realization, and it was a rapid evolution. It was not something, you know, light can come at you sometimes so intensely that it is literally blinding. And there were moments when we simply could not believe our own eyes, that we did not even trust our own sensory perceptions of what was happening to us and how we evolved and actually came to terms with our place and shared space and the presence and the entities that we shared that house with, that was theirs long before it was our own. And the thing that's, to me, the most fascinating is that I always describe the place as a portal cleverly disguised as a farmhouse. And it's not just a portal to the past, it's a portal to the future. My mother one night saw an entire family eating dinner in our dining room, a dining room that I had just walked through that was shut down for the night. All the lights were off, and she turned around, and there's a mother cooking food over a fireplace that was raging, that had been sealed shut for more than 100 years, chastising her children to go take their seats at a table that was not our own, on benches that we did not have, and two men were sitting on the other side of the table.
You know, a very interesting concept how you're saying that, because you're seeing it from different people's eyes.
Right, and the two men that were sitting at the table, they were drinking out of steins. Steins had not been in use in this country for hundreds of years. And one of them looked into the parlor and saw my mother standing in front of the fireplace, and he nudged the man beside him and pointed to my mother, and my mother was the ghost.
Wow.
To them.
Wow.
It's
incredible. Yeah, I'll tell you something. Though. It is when Jeff and I were doing, this is fiction we were writing, but when we wrote our horror story, we saw the kitchen. I saw the people differently than he saw the people, okay? And it was really weird because he saw the kitchen a different room when they were looking at people that were not alive. I saw it a different way. He saw it one way, but we were writing it together, but we didn't see the same room. And that was, you know, that was so interesting because we both took it a different way. You know, I said, no, I think the stairs go this way. No, they don't, you know. But it is, and your family, you know, when people were sitting there, it was whoever saw whatever they saw. See, this is very incredible. I'm probably going to right now read my script again, thinking, like, what did I do here? You know, because the truth is, I think more people than you think see things like this. I think that there'll be... Yeah, I think this should be an interesting, and I'm open to a show like that. So hopefully soon we will have one like that where you could come on and we will have other people talk to you because you might bring out something in them that they'd like to hear. You know?
Oh,
and,
I would love to do that.
We'll do this.
Tell your followers, tell your readers and your listeners
I will be.
That they can find me. I have quite a substantial. I love Facebook. I think it's the greatest invention since sliced bread. And I have a personal page under my own name.
Right.
I also have a House of Darkness, House of Light page that has everything, all news releases, interviews.
Yeah, it has all
everything
your
coming
I
out
that,
about
that's
the book.
Out too. Right, that's
mm-hmm.
out too. So we'll do that again. And anytime, you know, and if there's something new that you want to discuss, this will be
mm-hmm.
fine. You know,
and
so at where's your next speaking? You're going to be speaking
Saturday.
Said,
I'm speaking at Through the Veil in Atlanta,
okay.
which is the big Paracon.
Right. Okay.
You can find all the links for information to that on my Facebook book page, the author book page, and also on my website. And I've also just produced a DVD that is going to help launch Mysterious World Television. That's Angie Stockman and Devin Belanger, who are the brain women behind this. I mean, they're just incredible women.
So what's
and,
that called again? Could you repeat that?
Mysterious World TV, MWTV, is going to be launching very soon with one of my videos. I did an extensive interview with them, and they turned it into just this magical piece of video. I'm so pleased, and I'm so proud.
So if we don't
associated.
See some of these, just send it to me, and I'll put it out.
Okay.
Because, you know,
okay.
this is, you know, what you say. See, sometimes Facebook does not always send everybody the same messages. I've had people on my show saying this, so that's why I'm repeating this now, that I will put it out in different ways. I know I don't know what to, there's so many people out all over the place. So thank
I
you
know.
Again, and I appreciate it. And this was truly just I can't say I don't know what it is. It was great just to hear you read it, and I can really see how much depth of character you placed in this.
Oh, thank you so much. I truly appreciate
okay,
it.
Okay,
and
Candy, I know she'll
time.
Probably get in touch. And Bethany, thank you very much. And I will be on Friday again. Okay, thank you again. Take care. Good night, everybody.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.